The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Hello and welcome to Squawk Box. Here are your headlines today. From strength to strength, the U.S. jobs report beats expectations, sending equities higher and tempering expectations that the Fed will start easing in June. UBS CEO Sergio Ermotti calls on Europe to create more competitive banks, telling CNBC at the Ambrosetti Forum, integration of Credit Suisse is a case study for the continent.
We can't just rely on a crisis to create or facilitate the merger of banks. There has to be a political desire to facilitate something like it.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen threading a diplomatic needle, at least attempting to, as she urges China to rein in excess capacity. We'll hear exclusively from the secretary in Beijing at 11 a.m. CET. And China's commerce minister pushes back at accusations of overcapacity during a visit to Europe, rebutting claims the country's EV industry has benefited from unfair subsidies. And Europe's largest travel group, TUI, gets set to ring the opening bell in Frankfurt, upgrading to the prime standard market after ditching its London listing. We'll speak exclusively to the CEO. That's coming up at 10:45 CET.
Another roll of strong data as we closed out the trading week, again testing the bear theory, but also for markets that have escalated to levels that we've seen. Now, the U.S. posted job growth of 303,000 for the month of March. That was well ahead of expectations and higher than the 270,000 recorded in February. The unemployment rate, that edged down to 3.8%, while hourly earnings rose 0.3%. on the month, in line with estimates, but not exactly the data you expect at this point in the cycle. U.S. National Economic Council Director Lael Brainard told CNBC the data backs her optimism for the economy.
I think this is a really very encouraging report. It suggests that the U.S. economy can continue expanding with the labor market in a really balanced way. We've now surpassed the 15 million new job milestone since President Biden has taken office, and we're doing it with unemployment down below 4% for over 2 years, inflation having come down dramatically over that time. And as you said, the labor supply has expanded, labor force participation is really strong, up relative to pre-pandemic. Those are all really good outcomes for American workers, the American economy.
Amid all the talk of when to cut, Fed Governor Michelle Bowman has said there is a risk the Fed may have to raise interest rates if progress on inflation stalls or reverses. Bowman warned against cutting too soon, saying premature easing could lead to a rebound in inflation. Well, as for the traders, they've continued to pare back their bets on Fed easing in recent days, with markets now implying a more than 50% chance of the central bank remaining on hold at its June meeting. That's according to LSEG data. The former St. Louis Fed president and dean of Purdue University, James Bullard, told CNBC the Fed has to consider the timing of its first rate cut carefully.
If they can show some disinflation, the continuation of the disinflation trend that we had, especially in the second half of last year, that will give the committee comfort to make this first move. And I do think there's the notion that the first move is more momentous than any subsequent moves because you're kind of setting a direction. And so they want to be careful about exactly what moment they would choose.
So it's all about the moves. When do they begin? When do they not, perhaps? We're sitting pretty much at that 50-50 mark, as Karen just showed there, when it comes to that rate cut. Even just happening in June, right? We've also been hearing from the likes of Neel Kashkari speaking about maybe no cut is ultimately necessary at this stage. You've got a few other Fed speakers then really just looking at whether things perhaps need to stay the same or maybe a little bit more patience is ultimately needed. Last week, Friday, we saw a rebound in this market picture following that non-farm payrolls data, because the jobs numbers came out at 303,000 additional jobs then added in the month of March then. And while that top line figure, of course, blows the lights out when the market had anticipated around 200,000 jobs being added, the devil's really in the details, right? That average hourly earnings was the one that really markets were really looking towards as well there. And really was that 3.8% number then, as wages rose 0.3% on the month, 4.1% then on the year. The market looking at the joblessness slipping then to 3.8% from 3.9%. It's a hot print on the top end as well, but that wages figure will be the one that perhaps the market will be looking at. So on the back of it, we saw buoyancy in the market, a return to the buoyant mood we have seen pretty much for most parts of this year, a more than 1% uptick on Friday. But that didn't do too much then to help the overall trade then on the week. And this is what the Dow then pretty much looked like across last week then, managing to then gain significantly towards the closing end then of the week. On that 1 week change though, 1.6% weaker though is pretty much what you saw. Just to really focus in even on the S&P 500, it was on the downside, right? And despite Friday's uptick, only two of the 11 sectors managed to pick up gains. What were those? Well, energy and communications. Again, let's remember that energy picked up on the back of oil prices hitting those record highs, or significant highs, should I say, $89 or so per barrel for Brent crude oil. On your treasuries front then, US yield surged on Friday on the back of that non-farm payrolls figure. I mean, we passed that 4.4% figure quite significantly, a four-month high as well on the 10-year treasury note. On the bottom end, 4.78 is where we're seeing that two-year note. Then again, question marks will be asked as to whether that hot print means June does come into play again, or whether it might be off the table. Dollar crosses then, currencies boosted by that rise in treasury yields, as you've been noting, pretty much on the flat line then just for today. But 126.31 for sterling, the combined currency of the euro, 108. We're still looking out for that 152 mark then across the yen at present, even though we've heard from a lot of Japanese authorities around that mark. 151.77 is where we are right now. Onto the commodities market then. This has been interesting because we've seen record highs specifically then for spot gold. It did ease off that mark just earlier today, but now back up. Look at that. 0.5% higher, $2,340 an ounce there, while you're seeing Brent crude at $85 for WTI, should I say. Brent crude still slipping off that $90 a barrel mark, those record highs just last week. And the Asian market picture, a rebound here, much like the United States, is pretty much what you're seeing after the numbers coming out last week. The Nikkei rebounding to cross that 39,000 point mark, that 40,000 what you hit, of course, just last week. As you can see, a rise then of 0.75%, slippage though when looking at the Shanghai market. Karen.
Arabile, let's get some thoughts on the markets with George Lagarius, who is chief economist at Mazars. George, hard to hold on to a bear case at this stage after the latest print of blockbuster jobs numbers that crossed on Friday. We roll on this week to the CPI numbers. What's your playbook now as we waited out for more data? Is it likely that we're still going to get rate cuts, say, June and July?
So the rate cuts in June are not as likely. The market is still pricing in rate cuts in July. Personally, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw less rate cuts and pushed more towards the end of the year. This is a strong economy. Make no mistake, it is backed by debt and somewhat by overburdened credit cards, but it is a strong economy, so the Fed will struggle to find the case to cut rates soon.
George, what are we dealing with when it comes to the jobs market? Because that is what seems to continue to foil the central banks, that we've still got this very strong immigration story that's playing out in the United States, more productivity, more participation. At what point do we see some of these factors start to tilt in the opposite direction?
First of all, what we're dealing with is a 6.5% deficit funding the economy. So it's natural that a lot of that money will find their way into the real economy. if you add the immigration story to it, obviously you get a very positive picture. Having said that, the U.S. Is projected to run a very high deficit through the next years. It is projected to pay 3.5% of its GDP in interest payments in the next few years while growing 2%. And it's projected to have a 131 debt to GDP in by 2028 by the CBO, the Congressional Budgeting Office. So what we're seeing is a political choice made not to have a recession ahead of an election, not to have a slowdown, but rather steam ahead and have a strong economy. And the Fed, which is an independent institution, now has to take all of that into account and consider what this all means for rate cuts.
Yeah, good morning to you, George. I mean, the question here is, are you surprised that you have so many Fed speakers pretty much reacting to every piece of data that they find out there? Or does this kind of showcase how worried they are about getting this right?
So the Fed has been punishing itself ever since 2021, when Team Transitory ostensibly got it wrong. My personal contention is that without Ukraine, the picture might have been difficult, but you know that's not how we write history. However, what they feel is that they can't get it wrong again, which means that they're more likely to err in the side of caution. Okay, they can't see inflation tick up. And as you very well said, oil is ticking up. All the PMI indices suggest that producer prices have also been picking up. You know, and if it wasn't for China deflating things right now, decisions could have been a lot different. And you could have seen an even more hawkish Fed.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see a more hawkish Fed, I mean, one just needs to consider that if you get an inflation print this week that is even hotter than the market had anticipated, surely you begin to question whether you see any cuts at all. And maybe later on you begin to have the thought process that maybe we'll begin to see hikes. Does that fit into any of the algorithms now?
I don't think the algos are playing that outcome, but it does fit into the thinking of a lot of people in the market. Look, in October, which is not that far behind, we were all apprehensive about the many rate cuts that were in front of us. It is still very likely that we will see rate cuts this year, okay? Because the Fed does have room to cut even today. You know, they could have room to cut half a percentage or even a whole percentage point. Remember, they're not at the neutral rate. They're way above it. So they do have some room to cut, but they don't want to get it wrong. They do not want to be the Fed that cut rates as inflation kept beating expectations. So they want to see more data towards the right direction. And they are willing to wait. The economy, at least, is making it easier for them.
Well, George, I remember them just saying not so long ago that higher for longer was pretty much the stance. And that's really where we are right now. So it sounds like they're just keeping to their word. George, thank you so much for the time, though, this morning. Appreciate it. George Lagarias is the chief economist at Mazars. Now, what's coming up on the show? Well, UBS CEO Sergio Ermotti is calling for Europe's banking union to be completed so that more major bank mergers can take place. We'll have the details of that next. Also ahead, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Well, she's preparing to conclude her latest visit to China with alleged unfair trade practices high on the agenda. And later today, TUI continues work to move its listing out of London and over to Frankfurt. We'll speak to the CEO, Sebastian Ebel, in an exclusive interview that's coming up at 10:45 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
A UBS CEO Sergio Motti says he hopes that authorities will one day allow mergers between major banks, but warned that he doesn't expect it to happen soon. Motti was speaking to Steve at the European House Ambrosetti workshop, where the banking boss said his company's takeover of Credit Suisse can act as a case study for what is possible.
If we are successful, and I believe we will, and we are as we speak in integrating Credit Suisse, i.e. two global systemic relevant banks, is going to be a case study to be evaluated globally, but also particularly in Europe, where eventually the necessity of creating stronger banks and stronger and more competitive banks from a global standpoint of view is, in my point of view, a necessity. In order to achieve that, I just had a chance to mention that, also reiterate these comments I made to you. Of course, we can't just rely on a crisis to create or facilitate the merger of banks. I mean, of course, it's good to have strong players that can be part of the solution, like UBS was in the Credit Suisse case. And by the way, as we speak, as of now, UBS of today is the outcome of 520 acquisitions in 160 years. Many of them were driven by strategic decisions, but many of them were driven by banks being in troubles and us being allowed or asked to be part of the solutions. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but it cannot be just that part. So, but in that sense, I think that the real issue is not, there has to be a political desire to facilitate something like that. So, and it's not the reality of today. The good news is that, in my view, in many countries, there is a recognition that they want to protect their banks and their financial institutions as national champions, which is an implied or explicit recognition of their value for their economies. But the bad news is that they don't realize that in order to really be meaningful and go to the next level of their contribution in their economies, they would need to be also more competitive globally. And so, but without a banking union, without a capital market union, it's going to be very, very difficult for Europe to compete with the U.S. large banks. And fundamentally, you all know that the economies and are still relying in Europe to the banking sector for financing for 70% of the business of the cases. In the US, it's the other way around. So we have a completely different playing field and lack of critical mass. So I'm not so convinced it's going to happen soon, but I hope eventually one day those kind of mergers between larger banks will be allowed, and we can contribute to that by showing that it's possible.
Sergio Motti there talking about the role of this consolidation we've seen over at UBS and Credit Suisse as a case study, as a potential, not a blueprint. Yep. Note the use of language there, because if you think about a blueprint, that's something quite different. And the consolidation we've seen between these two banks, creating such a large entity, $1.6 trillion in assets on balance sheet to twice the size of the Swiss economy. Who would actually want that across another European country? After all the history that we've seen around the problems that emanated 10-plus years ago across in Europe, hard to see that there would be political desire, given the bailouts that were required, who would want to create a beast that gigantic, that it would be hard to manage if there were problems.
Yeah, especially creating one in a crisis situation, right? You'd want mergers like that. And I mean, UBS were very reluctant to even be part of this. Let's remember that, right? This wasn't their first port of call. It's just when the market then pretty much had to happen. And as he was even noting there, did Sergio Motti, that it can't be because of a state of crisis that mergers like these actually begin to happen. And it really does begin to create perhaps a difficult situation for lenders, because they sit there thinking, well, we're going to have to bail out somebody else or buy into somebody else, and maybe a business that doesn't necessarily fit in as well for them. I mean, they were speaking just last week, just with regards to how the entity has actually fitted into them. They took on a little bit more than they thought they actually had, and it didn't work out as well for them as they thought it had initially. So it does pose a few questions with regards to mergers, especially in the lending space, which can be quite volatile.
I take Amotti's point about creating a large European champion that can compete with some of the US banks, some of the US peers. And the most obvious one that would jump out would be a Deutsche Bank, a larger Deutsche Bank, maybe Commerzbank consolidation. But that one has been insurmountable thanks to what we've seen in terms of having to take write-downs, reassess the value assets, thanks to accounting rules, but also capital markets union. If you think about growing the business across borders, that's been something that has not happened. So as a result, banks, in terms of cross-border mergers, that's not been an option either. If you take away a potential consolidation opportunity, that, of course, impacts the premium on some of these assets as well. So I think there are so many different hurdles here. In terms of not consolidating a crisis, just to that point, you think about how much was wiped out for the value of those major shareholders from the Saudi National Bank to Qatar and also to other major entities. So you don't want that to happen because you don't want to destroy the merits of investing in European banks, particularly at this point when we have such a fantastic environment for the banks. It's been the best it's been in many years.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not also forget on the other side, you have that European Banking Union. I mean, this is something we've been speaking about for a significant amount of time now as well, haven't we? And, you know, if it was to ultimately be carried out as perhaps envisaged, you could actually, you know, perhaps fight out a lot with regards to the strengthening of Europe itself. It would ultimately complete the creation of a single market for financial services throughout Europe and really create a significant strength. So that would be one positive to really look out for. So, yeah, some interesting points then to have come out of that conversation then with Steve, of course, out of Ambrosetti just last week. Let's move on then. There is always a way to navigate risk in emerging markets with the right approach. That's according to Robert Kunigsberger, who is the founder and CIO of emerging market investment manager Gramercy. He told Steve that investors shouldn't just take emerging markets as a whole and instead should do their homework.
There's this dichotomy between the high expected returns and actually the high returns that are there and the experiences that people remember. And what I mean by that is, you know, EM's proven to have outperformed most of the major asset classes, and I'm talking about EM debt over the past 20 years. But when I talk to people about emerging markets, they talk to me about the bad experiences they've had, the tequila crisis, the vodka crisis, the caipirinha crisis. And, you know, we think that, you know, the greatest mistake people make in emerging markets is they tend to buy the wrong thing at the wrong time. Mm. They stick with it for too long, and then they capitulate. And so what I talked about today is a different approach, which is more of a high conviction barbell approach where you really own what you want to own. You don't own what you don't want to own. What I mean, this is not a market for index-based investing or ETFs. Over the last 3 years, the index is down 11%. Some countries are up 90% and some are down 90%. There's a lot of dispersion.
And it's just that everything you just said is a classic metaphor for investing generally. Do your homework, have a look bottom up rather than top down, and actually be agile as well. These are all lessons for all investing, but emerging markets, I guess, just comes with that extra couple of notches of volatility.
Yeah, it is, and I think, you know, what emerging markets gets known for is that volatility or the idiosyncratic risk, but there are ways to navigate that risk through the approach. And if you take a high conviction approach and you don't take a beta approach, and you do smart things like structuring credit and do asset-backed lending and what have you, you know, there's really high returns to be captured. The challenge people have had in emerging markets is they don't have the right governance for, when I say they, the portfolio investors.
Right.
So the ability to go from A to B is you have to have the skill set, you have to have the confidence, and you have to have the governance from a board of directors, whatever it may be. That all goes against being agile, right? So how do you go from overbought in the fourth quarter of 2019, oversold because of a pandemic in March of 2020, and overbought again? I mean, and people just had a steady portfolio. So we spend a lot of time talking to investors about make sure you have the right construct or the right governance in place to be agile.
That being Robert Kunigsberger, who was speaking, of course, then to Steve just last week. Now, Israel says it has withdrawn troops from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza in preparation for a move on Hamas's last significant stronghold, that being Rafah. This is despite international concern over the threat, such as an attack which would pose to civilians. In the last few hours, Egyptian state-affiliated media said truce talks between Israel and Hamas are making progress all parties agreeing on basic points. None of the parties involved have confirmed this. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu marked a milestone in the conflict.
We are today marking 6 months of war. The achievements of the war are great. We eliminated 19 out of 24 Hamas battalions, including senior commanders. We killed, wounded, or captured a significant number of Hamas terrorists. We cleared Shifa, as well as many other terrorist headquarters. We destroyed rocket manufacturing plants, war rooms, weapons and ammunition caches, and we continue to systematically destroy the underground tunnels. We are a step away from victory. I made it clear to the international community, there will be no ceasefire without the return of hostages. It just won't happen.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.